Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin, talking to you live from Chicago, Illinois. I've got my cohorts with me today, Jim Marty from Longmont and Rob Hunt, this time from the opposite end of the country out in New York. We have a very, very special guest on our show today, Maddie Veach, who's got some great experience in both the cannabis and rock and roll industry, has some good stories to tell, and something you don't want to miss. We've got some outstanding cannabis news we're going to lead with. And if we have time at the end, there was a great show the Dead played today back in 1969 in Piedmont Park in Georgia that was famous for a lot of reasons, and hopefully we'll have time to talk to you about that one too. But let's dive into what's going on in the marijuana world, I think, really quickly. And starting with Jim Marty. Jim, tell us the story that we were just talking about. Talk about it with our listeners.
Well, there's a Colorado case that tried to get their case heard by the Supreme Court, and although they were turned down, Judge Clarence Thomas writ a petition respecting the denial of the centoria, all legal terms. But the huge piece of this is that the current marijuana laws are both in and out at the federal level, and that cannot stand. And actually, Justice Thomas, and we think, I suspect Gorsuch helped him with this, but I just want to read a couple sentences from this. Once comprehensive, the federal government's current approach is half in and half out, a regime that simultaneously tolerates and forbids local use of marijuana. This contradictory principle creates an unstable state of affairs and strains the basic principles of federalism, which for our listeners who are not schooled in the school of law, federalism means that the federal laws trump state law, in very simple terms. Goes back to the Whiskey Rebellion in the Washington's administration. I'll cut to the conclusion, because he kind of gives a path here for the future. A prohibition, and he uses this very specific word, a prohibition on intrastate, i.e. within a state, use or cultivation of marijuana may no longer be necessary or proper to support the federal government's piecemeal approach. So he's kind of pointing it back to the Congress, say, you know, hey, why don't you just let the states do what they want, which actually there's a bill in Congress called the States Act that does exactly that. And as you've heard me say on this show many times, that's what we want. That gives us our deductions, 280E goes away, but it keeps out big pharma, big tobacco, big alcohol, and there's no cross-border trafficking. Within the states, you can do what you want. So this is huge, and it's been all over the press the last few days. This came out just 2 days ago, the 28th.
Well, Jim, what's really, for me as a litigator, what's really impressive about this opinion is, you're right, he does. He lays out a path forward for people who want to challenge the federal application of law on the state level. And, you know, we've always looked at that and said, you know, can the feds come in? Well, here's what he's saying. There was a case previously, the Raich case, in which the Supreme Court overwhelmingly held that the federal government had the right to enact laws that made cannabis illegal, marijuana illegal, and that they could impose those laws even if the states felt otherwise. What he's saying now is that the states, that the federal government has not been enforcing its laws in a consistent fashion. And he's basically referring to the fact that if you're going to allow states to go adult use and ignore federal law, what he's saying is that the federal government is undermining its very rationale for the Raich decision, meaning that in the future, the federal government will not be able to rely on that as potentially not be able to rely on that as precedent if somebody brings a law, a case challenging some of these laws. He's basically saying that the government may now find itself to be estopped. Estoppel is a legal word, meaning that you're barred. They may be estopped from actually trying to enforce some of these laws. And the fact that it's coming from Thomas, one of the most conservative justices there is, I think is both amazing and ironic, because I think he's doing it to criticize the federal government's approach. But in criticizing the federal government, he's laying out a game plan for those of us who are always contemplating ways to be able to challenge a federal bar on marijuana.
Yeah, let me read from this again, because he opens up a huge Pandora's box. So if the government is now content to allow states to act as laboratories and try novel social and economic experiments, then it might no longer have authority to intrude on the state's core police powers, define criminal law, and to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their citizens. I mean, this is huge.
So I think what's really interesting there, and anyone that followed the case back in 2005, which is the Gonzales v. Wright case that we're talking about, they used a really obscure ruling at the time when there was very few cannabis laws on the books in any of the states. And what they used was a dormant commerce clause issue that related to a 1930s case that was called Willard v. Filburn, which everyone learns about in constitutional law because it's what's called the aggregate effect test, which means, you know, if the aggregate effect of something that happens widespread is enough to affect interstate commerce, then the federal government can actually regulate intrastate commerce. And what they said in this case is in Willard v. Filburn, back in the old days, it was a case about whether or not wheat farmers were allowed to grow wheat for the farm workers that worked on their farms. And what they said is that if every farmer out there that was supporting a bunch of farm workers was growing wheat and using that wheat to feed their farm workers, then it might not be a big deal farm by farm, but the aggregate effect across the country would be harmful and detrimental to the wheat industry as a whole. So they created this test that they would use as an aggregate effect anytime they thought about interstate or dormant commerce clause issues. So in 2005, they pulled this thing out that hadn't been thought of in years and said, okay, well, California's intrastate commerce of cannabis with a medical law, if we actually allow that to happen, then that's going to affect what happens in interstate commerce. And we've already made a determination as a federal government that cannabis is illegal at the federal level. So we can't allow for California to go a separate way, knowing that the intrastate commerce is going to affect the interstate commerce. So that is largely what's prevented us from 2005 until today from being able to move cannabis across state lines, even with contiguous states that have legal programs. So you can't go from California to Oregon to Washington. You can't go from, you know, Massachusetts to Maine to New Hampshire. That's why we can't move cannabis across state lines. But at the time, it made a little bit of sense because there's very few states that had any sort of cannabis laws in the books at all. And Thomas, when he ruled on it back in 2005, supported that decision saying, you know, this is where we are. What he's saying now is we've come so far since then. There's now 36 states that have medicinal programs on the books. There's north of 14 states with adult use. If we're not going to enforce these laws, then the rationale that we relied on in Gonzales v. Reich in 2005 is no longer applicable in 2021.
Good explanation, Rob. Thank you. That's spot on and makes it very understandable.
We might actually see some movement here at the federal level because as far as I can see, nothing's happening in Congress right now.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath on that. I think we're not going to see anything at the federal level, but I do think it's nice when you see a very conservative justice saying if this question were to come in front of us again, likely we'd rule differently. So it should give, yes, you know, a fair amount of confidence to people that think, okay, if we do want to put this forward, do we at least have the support of the more conservative side of the court? And the answer is that, you know, if you think that Thomas might be the most conservative, if not, you know, top two most conservative, it's a very good harbinger of how the court would rule and what he's sending as a signal to the lower courts before it even gets to his desk.
Okay, so that was one exciting bit of news. Jim, another thing that just happens to involve Colorado, we saw an article about, is that it looks like Colorado's going to start putting caps on the amount of extracts that medical patients can purchase. Are you familiar with this new rule?
Yeah, I am, and happy to say that we had a bit of, you know, the group that I'm a part of, Colorado Leads, is a Colorado lobbying group that my company Bridge West supports. And it's actually, a little bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing. It's actually a victory because it started out as a potency cap for all cannabis. And what the really issue was of the prohibitionists, as I call them affectionately, is they were concerned about high concentrates going to teenagers, a practice called looping, where a cannabis patient, teenager, would buy his maximum and then sell it to his friends. So that's where the potency argument came from. And we were able to redirect that and say, hey, listen, we don't need a potency cap for adult use and for adults, but we understand your concern about looping. So let's put some limits on what, because you can be 10 years old and be a medical patient in Colorado with your parents' permission.
Yeah, but those kids aren't looping, man. Those kids, if they get their parents' permission, those kids are getting their medicine under parents' or parental supervision. They're only getting what they need. This is much more geared towards, you know, the fact that there was no delineation between really, really strong concentrates and less strong products, and guys were able to purchase a ton of product that was way more than anyone needed for personal use. So, yeah, I think, you know, let's... let's call this what it is, which is trying to cure the dab heads from having just way too much access to massive amounts of concentrate. And if you're doing that, then I don't think there's anyone on this podcast that doesn't support the idea of, like, you don't need to buy an ounce of concentrate or an ounce of wax or shattered butter or any of that stuff at a time. It makes a lot more sense to say, hey, let's, reduce the amount of concentrate you can get in favor of saying, okay, you can have an ounce of weed, but you can't have, an ounce of concentrate. Those are, that's like saying go out and buy cases of Everclear. Nobody needs it.
Correct. And so we look at this as a victory. We're able to redirect the potency cap to something we all can agree on. It's that, teenagers should not be getting their hands on medical marijuana or concentrates.
No, I agree with that. And I think, Rob, you make a good point. My only concern is that once the government starts creeping in and putting limits on things, then the only question is, have we opened a door and how far can they go with it? And can they, eventually accomplish from within what they weren't able to accomplish from on the outside? And, maybe I'm a little paranoid when I say that, but after, 50 years of, playing this game, I can't quite get rid of that feeling.
No, I think you're spot on, Larry, but, my answer to that is the same one I always have, which is if we legalized everything, then we wouldn't have those same issues because there'd be no need for looping because people would actually have access. So when you've got, situations where people can't gain access through an easy source legally in their area, then it causes them to, look to the illicit market or to divert from the legal market to the illicit market, whether it means product, being produced in California or Colorado and shifting over to Nebraska and Kansas, or whether it means, diverting to younger, younger people in the population. Either way, I think we're supporters of putting in sensible regulations to prevent that from happening. And the best way to do it is to, to have better access to the public and to make sure, everyone knows there's penalties to diverting to children, and I think that the same thing has happened for alcohol for years. Like, no one tells me how many cases of beer I can buy, but I certainly know that I can't give it to my neighbor's kid. So, we just have to be careful about that and make sure that we explain to the government this isn't about, expanding or being okay with, controlling the amount. It's much more about putting in sensible policies that we can all adhere to. And if you do, then there shouldn't be any issues or any more than there are with any other substance.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to say something else?
Well, I was going to say, it's a great transition because if anyone knows, about a bunch of dab heads, it's Matty Veach, So, we got to get him involved in this conversation because I can tell you that he hangs out with kids in the parking lot all the time and just, make sure that they're all having a good time at the shows that he works at. So, I think he's probably seen plenty of kids that probably have done one or two too many hot plates or, quartz nails or whatever, whatever people are dabbing off these days. But Matty, how you doing, brother? It's great to see you and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate you guys having me. Well, the whole dab thing is funny because to me it is completely a different world. I mean, I can remember, I would say 2012 around maybe 11. It was New Year's Eve at First Bank Center, and we were working String Cheese New Year's, and the photographers were using my office as a storage spot, and they had a dab rig, the size of what looked like a hookah to me, but I just didn't, with the whole, with the heat gun and the whole thing, it kind of threw me off. I had no idea what was going on. I was just like, what are y'all doing? Obviously, it's pretty more mainstream these days, but after my little bit with dabs, I instantly went back to flower because I couldn't deal. It was just too much. I couldn't work. You wouldn't be able to understand me. That's for sure. ask Rob.
Gabagool.
Yeah. Right. But, I think the cap on this is probably a good thing, like you said. I mean, no one needs an ounce of shatter or butter, whatever you want to call it these days. I noticed from being down here the last 7 months in Florida that they were trying to do that to flower. Don't quote me on this, but I want to say the percentage was, they wanted to cap it at 10%, and the people here laughed at it because, what most marijuana now is what, 15 to almost 30, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going for potency, anything that's on the top shelf is normally, 22 to 30%.
Right.
And if you're going to start pushing people on 10%, all you're doing is pushing everyone back into the arms of the illicit market. It makes absolutely no. I mean, like, if you think about where Florida was for years with the Florida crypto and, all the original like OGs that were coming out of that area, their indoor cultivation tradition was pretty massive down there, and there's no way you're going to put, you know, the Florida kids back into 10% weed.
Well, and just the strains themselves that people, the growers trade among themselves are not even near that. You know, they're all, everyone's trading the same strains, so, or making new ones that are trying to be even more potent. They're not going to go down. But I'm pretty 100% sure they squashed it anyway. They thought it was a joke.
And I want to qualify my statement that when I say Florida kids, I'm talking about Florida kids over the age of 21. But, yes. But still in my mind, kids. You know, it's, right.
Good clarification, lawyer.
Yeah, the guys are out there that were growing weed for a long time in Florida. You know, we're sort of the drivers outside of California and outside of British Columbia. I always think of Florida as being one of the great growing traditions for a long time in the 90s. And like the Florida crypto is legendary. And there's no way you're pushing the guys that, you know, grew up with that as kind of their background back into the 10% cannabis.
I wonder if the nickname Crypto is still alive.
We just brought it back, man. I'm bringing Crippy back.
The Crippy. But definitely were quite a few of them out on the Grateful Dead lots back in the early or late 80s, early 90s.
So, Maddie, you just brought up New Year's at you know, First Bank with Cheese. If I remember, I think a year before that, you and I were at the Pepsi Center seeing Panic for New Year's back, you know, before you were working shows. What was the transition like from you going from, you know, I kind of talked about you and our history together and our friendship of, you know, you and I seeing tons of shows together and you kind of just being the person in the Boulder scene that literally knew every band, every manager, everyone else, never worked for a show, but just had access to everything just kind of because you're the Veach, right? So, you know, how did it go that you went from being DaVeach to all of a sudden getting, you know, these jobs and gigs where you're running the production for the stage at the Fox Theater, ultimately, you know, becoming the stage manager for String Cheese and now being the production and tour manager kind of for Anders Osborne. I mean, it's been an amazing, you know, 15 years watching you transition, and I'd love to kind of hear how that developed and, you know, how it went from being a fan that, you know, got to hang out and party all the time to having to, you know, be in those same venues, but, you know, wearing a laminate and having to be on radio.
Well, I'll tell you, it all started because of legalization and the medical progression in Colorado. You know, I saw it coming. I definitely had friends that moved from Colorado to California. They were, you know, everyone was complaining of prices being lowered. Demand was up, but supply was way up. So everyone was kind of struggling to find their niche in the growing market. And I just saw it as a opportunity for myself to just kind of get out of the rogue world and jump back into the working force. And we had a mutual friend, Scott Nichols, who at the time was my neighbor. And I literally went over there and said, put me in, coach. Like, I don't care where, what, you know, I'll do anything. And I really did for probably the first 3 or 4 years of my career. I did anything. I was a stagehand. I was a runner. I was, basically the lowest echelon and just worked my way up. And because of my, you know, where it is true is who you know in this world. I mean, it definitely helped. And I had a lot of connections with the Colorado music scene, which at the time, the company I was working for that was production managing String Cheese was Scott Nichols' company, All Phases. And that's kind of where I got my foot in the door. I mean, I literally went from sweeping the garage at the old String Cheese warehouse to production manager, which in 10 years, which was pretty cool to me. And I mean, a lot of stuff, obviously before it doesn't happen overnight. Lots of, you know, 16, 18 hour festival days, doing shitty jobs, you know, stagehand work is not glorified by any means. It might look it when you're from a friend who sees you standing on the stage watching the show, but they don't realize that you were there for 12 hours since 7 in the morning, and then the show starts at 7 and they just got there 5 minutes ago. I mean, it's brutal. And then you got to be there for another 2 to 4 hours after the show to clean up, to load out, depending on what band's there. I mean, you know, these days would turn into 20, even up to 20, 24 hours and just be whooped. Then slowly, as other people kind of moved on in the music industry, I was a backline tech for a summer tour, String Cheese. I did bass and both drum kits. Then the year after that, I got hired on as full-time as stage manager. And then about 3 years after that, our production manager got up and moved on to a different career. And I jumped in as production manager. So it was kind of an absorption job. I wasn't really promoted in any way. I kind of absorbed the job, but it was still a promotion, obviously, to me. And then I kind of, String Cheese just became a bit too much, and we parted ways in 2019. And now I'm with Anders, who has helped me tremendously because I've been, as Rob knows, I've recently become 100% sober, and Anders is 12 years sober. So being with him has just been awesome, and just there's no enabling going on that tour. And I run it, it's a dry backstage, it's all that. And compared to String Cheese, String Cheese was always a party backstage. I mean, they went from kind of their hippie roots in Colorado, Boulder, Telluride, Durango, and just had so many friends. And those friends are still fans today, and the guest list was always huge. And I guess it just kind of wasn't, they couldn't say no, because this fan base built this band into what they are today. So, you know, and I get it. The pandemic's going to change all of that. I don't know, Jim, if you noticed that there was not many people backstage at Widespread Panic.
I did notice that, but out front, it was shoulder to shoulder.
Oh yeah, obviously. But I think the day of all the passes being handed out and being a party backstage are over for the time being, at least, which is going to make it easier for band and crew to work.
Yeah. There was a photographer back behind the drum kit taking some pictures. A lot of video, from different angles. A really good video of JoJo's hands playing the piano. Close-ups of David Schools. So now you're bringing me into the shows from last weekend, which kind of intermingled this conversation. But, you know, when you haven't seen somebody for over a year, you really notice that they've changed and aged a little bit. David Schools' long hair is going gray, and John Bell looked like shit, but big bags under his eyes. Looked like even though he was staying at the Ritz-Carlton, he wasn't getting a lot of sleep. But, yeah, they played really, really well, and God, even though it was a cold rain, man, talk about cold rain, 50 degrees, and it rained hard. I felt really bad for Panic and the fans because this was their first multi-night gig in a year, and it rained at showtime 3 days in a row. It rained in the afternoon while we're sitting on the steps, so it really put a damper on things, and I'm talking about waterfalls coming down the steps of Red Rocks. You've seen that before, I think, Maddie.
Yeah, many times. And I think, Rob, did you come to Red Rocks String Cheese in the last probably 5 years? I can't remember if you did. Sorry, my brain's a little frazzled.
Not in the last couple, no. I haven't been back in Colorado that much.
We had, we had to stop the show. We never had to cancel, thankfully, but there was just tons of times, always tarps, the stagehands were squeeging water off the stage. Luckily it's a rock, it's a cement platform, so it's not your normal stage, but when gear gets wet, it's no fun for anybody, especially the musicians. And most of these bands use carpet to put, because it absorbs sound, to put their pedal boards on, put their microphone stands, all that. So as soon as that gets wet, it's just a disaster. And Jim, all that video you saw was the company Nugs, I'm giving them a plug, I guess, Nugs.net, where they you can pay, I think, $20-$25 to stream the show from home, because we would use them on tour. We'd use Nugs, we'd use other carriers to do the video. So people that can't come to the show, which is, I mean, how awesome would that been if we could have watched Grateful Dead shows from home.
Right. Yeah, where was Brad Sterling when we needed him?
Yeah, right?
Guy came too late for us, but he's completely and totally changed the whole idea of couch tour and how we think about music for the jam band scene.
And I actually listened to some of it all three nights, actually, and the audio stream was so freaking good. I was very surprised how awesome it was through the computer.
Yeah, this year's shows at Red Rocks, the sound has been phenomenal. They built a new roof. The old roof was from 1988, and it was at the end of its life cycle. So last year, while they were shut down for COVID, they put an incredible state-of-the-art roof with built-in speakers. And the sound at Red Rocks is phenomenal. And I'm not surprised to hear it coming through their audio couch tour just as good.
Well, and I believe that the audio is provided by another plug, is a local company that we would use all the time, Brown Note.
Shout out to Ryan Knutson.
Yeah, Ryan Knutson, man. He's awesome, and his wife, Sarah, and they would provide audio and lighting for many, many bands that come through Colorado as well as over the country. But I believe they hung that audio. I haven't been back to Red Rocks this year, so I would imagine it's either a DMB K1 rig or K2 rig combined, but I'm not exactly sure. But I'd imagine it's going to just sit there or hang there all summer, so no one has to load in and out audio unless they want something different. But so that's pretty awesome. That takes about 2 to 3 hours out of the day of loading in for bands.
Yes, I've been to 4 shows so far at Red Rocks, and it's the same speaker setup every time for Spearhead, Bob Weir, and now Panic. Yeah, I think it does just stay there. Great sound system, just wonderful.
Hey, Maddie, I've got a question for you.
Go ahead.
I was a journalism major as an undergrad, and wound up writing sports for the Michigan Daily, which, you know, like you were saying, it always seemed like a lot of fun. You know, the guys sit in the press box, they get to go talk to the players after the game, get down on the field. And it was a very great experience from a journalistic perspective, and as a fan, it was kind of nice. But what I really found was, you know, it like you were saying, it really turned it into work. And it wasn't as much fun. You couldn't have fun at a game like all your buddies down in the stands screaming and yelling and carrying. You can't cheer in the press box. You can't, you know, you're there to perform a job and you're supposed to behave. And the game is over. Everybody else is going out to drink beers and you've got to write a story and deal with everything. And after a while, I'll tell you, it you know, when my senior year, Michigan was playing Ohio State at home for my final game. And I opted out of covering the game so I could go sit in the stands with my buddies and really, you know, have one last game of really whooping it up and having a good time. As a guy who's a huge music fan, and that clearly comes through, did you find that, you know, once you kind of crossed over onto the other side and started working on the crew and everything, did it change the musical experience for you?
Absolutely. But for me, I loved it. I mean, it gave me a sense of purpose. It gave me this newfound career, and I really did love it. But if you're a music fan where you only want to be there and to cheer and party and drink beers, that is not the career for you. You know, I mean, like it changed me and it helped me kind of grow as a person. It absolutely grow as a person. So I absolutely loved it because, you know, you form a family on the road with the crew and the band, and you're a family out there, and everyone relies on each other to do different jobs to get that show. I mean, you know, I would always compare it to other jobs where you could go into work, do your job, but not necessarily, it didn't matter, you know, unless, I guess I'll compare it to you where you were a writer, you had a time, you had a time crunch to get that story in, right? We had to be ready by 3 o'clock sound check, or there would be, you know, or people are going to be very angry. And obviously you'd need to be ready by 6 o'clock doors. Sure, we had to push doors back a few minutes here and there, but only, you know, but, you know, because of the whole, it's a team effort. There's no individual in the music world. I mean, yeah, at the end of the night when Widespread Panic hits the stage and all the girls are yelling for JB, yeah, that's a different story. But most people don't see, and I mean, Rob and I, friends, a lot of people know about the inner workings of the music industries. I can't vouch for everyone saying that because I think a lot of people are completely oblivious to it. I mean, they obviously you know, know that something's happening, but you know, some people I think are just completely just have no clue, and they might not want to have a clue, which is fine because they want to just have fun.
Well, that was my feeling. I never wanted to meet the athletes necessarily because I'm like, these guys are the guys I cheer for. What if they turn out to be jerks? You know,
right.
I'm just as happy. But I mean, once the show starts, do you have a few minutes where you can just stop and really watch and listen for a little while? Do you ever have that freedom to do that?
Yeah. I mean, we would wear the backline crew and the stage manager we had our own in-ear packs because nowadays everyone uses in-ear monitors. So we would have our own special audio pleasure of the show. I could literally go down to my office and still listen to the show while it was going on. And as well, you know, the Grateful Dead kind of started this back when, where they have their own in between microphones to band members, they can talk to each other. Same thing. Pretty sure Panic has the same thing. String Cheese, Fish. Actually, Fish does not use in ears. Maybe Paige does. But, you know, so when there's changes in the music, when they're going to abort a song, when they're going to let's go into this jam and they'll yell out some a chord cadence. You know, all that stuff's going on, and you know, no one has any idea in the fan base, but I do. So it's kind of cool. It's definitely a different interpretation of the show. You obviously know if shit goes wrong, and if shit goes right. I mean, they'll cheer each other on, or they'll get on each other for something. You know, you missed a chord, or you're totally out of you're in the wrong chord. You know, I mean, all kinds of stuff can happen where interpretation for someone else will be like, that was the best version of blah 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 ever, and I'm like, no, that was the worst version ever.
So Maddie, you're telling me that you can hear the whole thing through your earpiece, which means you can take your hula hoop anywhere you want into the audience and
anywhere.
Start hula hooping and still and still just like be rocking out waiting for the chord change, and when all the girls are like, oh, this is great, you'd be like, just wait 30 seconds, Kang said he's gonna do. Yeah. And like, you know exactly when to light up the glow sticks on your hula hoop.
Yep, exactly. I got a button for that.
Can I rent a pair of those earphones once? I'd like to just listen in for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad idea.
One of the things you were saying, I think is really interesting, because you and I both, you know, kind of got jumped into the music scene based on just who our friends were in music, and both of us kind of got pulled into it through friends that were already there. That you had a much better time with the transition. I could never stop and turn off the partying. I just wanted, you know, to keep it going. And ultimately, that's probably why it didn't work out that well as a long-term career for me. But I found it exceptionally annoying that people that didn't understand, like, all that went into what I was doing would see me at a show and be like, dude, what's up? Let's rage. And you're like, I'm working, man. I've got a radio on. Like, dude, you understand what it is I'm trying to, you know, get done so you can have a good time here. Do you find it hyper annoying, or did you, as you were making that transition, where everyone that kind of knew you as like someone they're used to partying with in the audience, that now we're going like, yeah, let's hang, dude, or get me up on stage, or do this, and you're like, go away, I got a job to do.
I got really, really good at blocking those people out. I was really good at ignoring people. The biggest annoying thing that would happen was one, someone would grab my microphone off my shoulder and yell into it. Most of the time they wouldn't press the button, so it wouldn't do anything. So, but that was super annoying. The second one was most cases in rock and roll, especially the very important ones, will say no drinks or do not put your drink on this case. Who puts their drink on the case? Every single person that's backstage, because they don't give a shit, and they look at it as a table or their drink resting spot. And so, I mean, many shows, it's like, I would just take my arm and freaking throw them all off and onto the floor, because it would just be so annoying. Because
dude, you used to be cool.
Yeah, exactly. But I get it. People get wasted and their brains just shut off to what's respect and what they should be doing. Now, I'm not saying this is everyone. People that have been back there for years obviously are super respectful, and a lot of people would say, dude, I get it. You got to work. But, you know, how many times, hey, smoke this bowl, do this, do ask to do this, that, or the other thing. And I just like, come on, man. Like, no. Like, I don't come into your office and ask you to do blow with you. Like, really? But, you know, it comes with the territory. And any roadie, any person in the industry has run into that, I'm sure, in their lifetime. I mean, even with Anders, I dealt with it. We did the Christmas shows at Tipitina's, and that was 2019 at the end. And I mean, Anders is a known sober person. And some people came into the green room, and some woman just was like, whipped something. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, absolutely not. What? This is wrong? Like, she thought, what am I doing? Why am I being a dick that I'm yelling at this woman for taking out drugs in a 12-year recovering addict's green room? You know, I mean, just people don't get it.
But I think you just brought up a great idea. Like at Seinfeld, where they said, let's go down and heckle people at their offices.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we should do this. I think we should actually show up with a big bag of blow and just roll into someone's office and just start cutting rails on their boss's desk and just be like, what? Yo, what's up, man? We're hanging. Yeah. You know?
What? This isn't cool? Just as like the, this isn't cool?
Yeah. Like, totally turn the tables. Just find out where that chick works and be like, all right, we'll see you on Monday.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, just your luck. Her boss will be like, I'm in.
Yeah, right. Probably. Well, it depends. I mean,
dude, are you the Veach? Can you get me tickets for next week?
Well, that another thing about what Rob just said is I would change phone numbers to funny names that had to do with ticket hoarders or ticket askers. And
Spongy Clown Nose.
Spongy Clown Nose, Dickhead Ticket List, you know, stuff like that, because when a year would pass, it would be maybe Red Rocks, it'd be New Year's, Electric Forest, all the big shows. They'd be like, hey, Maddie, what's up, dude? How are you, man? You know, like, can I get a ticket? And the last text was them was from a year ago for the exact same thing. And I'd be like, I just block or ignore. I wouldn't block them because I like reading them. It's kind of funny. And, you know, they, you know, obviously might be a friend or acquaintance or someone that just met me. And, you know, you learn who to ask and who not to. Nowadays, it's don't ask anything. I think a few of the Panic crew members were wearing shirts that said no backstage passes.
That's when I call Lopez and shake him down for one based on principle.
But yeah, I definitely did see no one backstage. Obviously, everyone's paying for tickets. I mean, yeah, these guys, everyone was struggling for a year plus, no income, basically taking out loans. They got to pay. A lot of bands took out loans to pay their crew to keep them employed. So they didn't have to go on unemployment. They didn't have to go become a truck driver or Amazon delivery guy just to pay the bills. I mean,
that's why I always tell all my friends, like, never ask for a free ticket until the show is sold out. When the show is sold out, then maybe, you know, but until then, buy a ticket, support the artist.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because they think it the opposite way. Like, oh, the show's sold out. There's no tickets. That's when I'm more likely, if I like you, to get you in if you're stuck outside. But if there's, you know, 1,000 tickets at the door, fuck that. Go, you got money. And I swear it's a Murphy's Law. It's like the richer they are, the more people, the richer they are, the more they ask for free stuff. Where the poor guys will go, poor women, men will go scrape up change from their car to go buy a ticket.
Totally. They're out in the parking lot asking for spare spills, you know? Like, working Sammy Smith big boys just to get in that show. Whereas the everyone else is asking.
Yeah, right? I mean, they're rolling around.
That's the great irony of this whole thing is that those that can afford to do it often don't because they think they've paid their dues or they think they've, you know, whatever. But my reaction is always like, you know, just support the artist whenever you can. If you can't, you know, don't be asking people for favors because eventually you are just that guy. But having said that, now you've been on our podcast, we all expect free tickets forever because, you know, we kind of broed you out on this one. So, you know, whatever tours you're doing, you know, like, yeah. It's kind of the quid pro quo that we just, you know, kind of make sure everyone understands before they come on the show.
All right.
Gotcha.
So good story from Sunday's show. You know, I think they need to redo those T-shirts that say "Never Miss a Sunday Show." Should say "Never Miss a Sunday Show" unless it's 50 degrees and raining.
Yeah, right.
Did they play a Chili Water Gym?
Oh my God! It was... But anyway, so went up there Sunday afternoon, sold out show. Didn't have tickets with my son Jack, who's 23, and you know the tickets on StubHub were $200 or more plus the fees. no, we're not going to pay $200. So we sat down by the box office all afternoon with a bunch of other people looking for tickets. And sure enough, a couple hours before the show, these two very beautiful women from Vail, Colorado, they turned out they were, come up, hey, I got two tickets. There was like 12 guys that had been waiting all afternoon for tickets. And I said, well, how many you got? She goes, I got two. And I just turned to the other guys. I said, hey, guys, I got two here. Do you mind if I roll with these ladies? No, go ahead, man, go for it. She goes, one condition is you have to go in with this. I mean, there's no more going through the parking lot looking for tickets because it's all on people's phones. So she goes, yeah, we'll sell you the tickets for face value, but you have to come in with us. I said, sure, let's go. Hop in my Suburban. I drove them up to the show and totally sold out show. We get in for face value. So our record stands intact. My sons and I have gone to many, many shows and sporting events without tickets, and we always get in.
Okay.
But back to the working at shows, I really enjoyed my time as a photojournalist for the Times Call here in Longmont. You know, you go to so many shows, and I've literally been to Red Rocks hundreds of times, you know, and it just felt good to be, you know, part of the working establishment behind the scenes there. You know, you're down in the pit for the first three songs taking pictures, and you go home and write your review. I enjoyed it very much. It is fun to be part of the infrastructure, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a completely different perspective when you're actually working on a show than it is when you're watching it. And I think that the first couple of times you actually go on radio and start, you know, really trying to be part of what you're putting on as the production, completely changes your thought process around what it is, and you never look at a show the same way again. Like when I go to see Cirque du Soleil now in Vegas, I don't look at it and watch the acrobats. I look at it and watch the production team and go, how are these guys changing stages so fast? Like how you know, what kind of lighting do they have in there? And like, you know, oh, those are studio spots and those are this. It's just a completely different way of looking at it. And I'm sure now with you, Matt, when you look at production, you know exactly what kind of PA they're flying. You know exactly what lighting they're flying. It's a completely different eye that you have for the event.
Well, yeah, I mean, we would literally, especially Red Rock shows and the bigger New Year's shows, Electric Force, I mean, we would spend 6 to 9 months on the preparation for lighting, video, just, you know, first finding vendors, then, you know, pricing fixtures, and then the lighting designer creating the plot for the show. And I think Jim mentioned the new roof at Red Rocks. It's huge. I mean, it's huge for touring bands because now you can hang lights and video much easier than you could before, where there was, you know, there's weight limits on the roof. There's point limits where, you know, you get a tech pack from a venue. The designer is going to be limited to what he can do by what is there. Obviously, with all these new venues and new structures going up, they're making it much easier. The Mission Ballroom, for one, Don Strasberg and many other people created that to incorporate shows from 2,000 to, I think, almost 4,000, to where the stage moves and all the points where the PA hangs and all the lighting can hang at different spots. So they can make an intimate show for 2,000 or the max capacity at, I think, 35 to 4,000. So where Don would say that there no show will ever not be sold out at the Mission Ballroom, which is pretty cool.
Listeners, is if you go to the Red Rocks website, you can see pictures of the new roof and read about its history and why it was replaced.
I was
replaced.
Just looking at it right now. It's very cool. It looks great.
And before that, there was. I'm not sure. I was not there, but the Grateful Dead in '87. Was there even a roof there?
No, I saw the Grateful Dead there in '84, and the second night they had a horrible, horrible rain and hailstorm. That knocked out the back window of our car. We got to the show late. It just was pouring all the. We had the waterfall going down the steps, and it was nasty. They played. I couldn't believe that they were up there playing, but they did.
Yes, it was a silver tarp roof. I have a picture of it in my barn.
Well, yeah, and I've dealt with that, the old roof, many times, and I mean, still, it was good. It served its purpose. We did a lot. We did a lot of cool stuff there. But now I haven't seen the tech pack for the new roof, but I imagine it's obviously state of the art. As Jim said, the PA, the speaker system is in place for the whole summer. I'm sure they'll take it out for the winter. But and just to tech it up. I'm not sure who actually, I would imagine AEG provided that, the audio for that, since they're mostly booking all the shows there.
Yeah, if you look at the Red Rocks website, there's literally a show every night.
Yeah. Oh, I've been seeing it. I mean, there's been Leftover Salmon, Umphrey's McGee, all kinds of bands already.
And that's almost all Don Strasberg. Donnie's pretty much, you know, through AEG is just straight running that place these days, along with, you know, multiple other venues in the market. Outside of just the new roof we were talking about before we got on, you know, the podcast, but, you know, there's a lot of other really cool parts of Red Rocks that I think people that haven't actually worked at that event or worked at that venue don't know about, starting from, you know, kind of how you load in, coming up from, you know, the trading post lot to, you know, the offices that are upstairs, you know, on either wing of the stage and, you know, kind of the backstage, how you have to go up the scaffolding to get into the backstage area, which is totally different than any other venue. But to me, one of the most amazing parts of Red Rocks, and I know you've had a lot of experience going back and forth through it, is the tunnel that goes down from where catering is up to the soundboard, which I think is in, what, the 15th row or 16th row of the center. And kind of like all the history and all the other stuff that goes along with that tunnel, that when you go through there, if you've been, you know, enough times through that tunnel, you get to sign your name into it. You know, anyone can do it that's in there. But, you know, I know I've got my name in there. I think Jim Marty says he signed his name in there, and I'm sure yours is in there somewhere as well, Maddie, as well as tons of our friends. But, you know, can you give any anecdotes kind of like why you love Red Rocks as a venue and why it's a fun venue to work?
I mean, number one reason is just how cool it is and how, you know, this natural amphitheater built into the rocks. It's not, you know, most venues, when you're on tour, I'll speak for theaters and arenas, you walk into those things in the morning and all you see is walls and kind of the same look everywhere you go. You know, you might be in some beautiful theater, but you're not seeing the sunshine. You're not, you know, they all kind of melt into the same thing once you do it enough times. And it can just get on you, on your psyche. It could be beautiful. You know, you'll go outside and maybe talk to a friend that's coming to the show and they're just like, oh, it's a beautiful day. And you're like, I would know. I had no idea. But Red Rocks, you know, you get there at 7 a.m. I've said this a few times. I'm sure people know about this, that there's always yoga in the morning. Actually, there's just people exercising at Red Rocks. And I would always say about, you know, we'd stand there on stage looking up at them. They'd be looking down at us and we're saying they're crazy. And they're looking down at us saying we're crazy because, so they're there till about 1 or 2 o'clock until the park kicks them out so they can get ready for the show. But I mean, we've been there on a Saturday. I want to say there's 1,000+ people out in the rocks, you know, enjoying the day because it's just such a gorgeous spot and it's free. You know, it's a state park. It's a city park, I guess.
It's a city and county of Denver park.
So, you know, anyone that doesn't know that, if you're visiting Colorado and it's a daytime, even if there is a show before, I want to say, well, let's go 1 o'clock, you can get in there and check it out in the fall. And in the winter when there's nothing going on, you can run up, you can jump on the stage. I actually did that with some family about 2 years ago, and they've never been there, and you know they're not going to come to a rock and roll show, but got to experience how beautiful it is just by walking in. And you can come in that upper lot where you don't have to walk, you know, up the treacherous stairs, as we all know how brutal they can be.
Yes, I always tell people going to a show at Red Rocks was a physical experience because you're going to be climbing a lot of stairs. Your heart's going to be pounding.
And another cool thing is that the musicians I've worked with who play there, that venue means more to them than a lot of other places. You know, when you're on tour, like I said, every place can kind of be ho-hum, same kind of place. But I mean, I've heard musicians vocally say they're nervous before the show. Because I mean, it's, you know, it's 9,600 people kind of just bearing down on you. And you walk out, we would set the band back, you know, probably 12 feet from the rail, because no one wants to be right there in their face, and you want to be in relation to where the speakers hang, so you're not getting any feedback. But it can be pretty emotional and scary at the same time. But it's just such an awesome experience. I mean, as a crew member, you look out into the crowd and you see 9,600 people just going bananas, dancing, smiling, just loving life. They're there for their favorite band, whether it's whoever it is. I mean, they do the symphony there with some. I know Warren Haynes did it. I'm pretty sure there's some other stuff going on this summer that with the symphony.
That's the show I normally dose for. You know, I'm the kid in the back that's just absolutely spinning out of control during the symphony.
Ten strip to the dome.
At least, probably just a big puddle.
But yeah, it's a special place, and everyone looks forward to Red Rocks. And going back to the tunnel, there's so many names written on that wall. You know, Bonnie Raitt. I saw Neil Young's name. I mean, it's just the list. There's so many names. Every musician you've ever thought of, or ever seen, or ever wanted to see has their name in that stairwell. And a lot of people, I mean, now it's more common knowledge that it's there. I think just from living in Colorado for so long, more people know about it that live there. But if you've never been to Red Rocks, or you don't know much about the music industry, you would have no clue it's there.
Yeah, well, I love that Carl and Joe Cahill have their little tribute in there as well.
For sure, for sure. I just saw a picture of Carl. That was weird. But the best part of it for me was, you know, obviously working for a jam band, before the show started, I was in charge of bringing the set list out to the front of house engineers, to the audio and lighting guys. In a venue, I'd have to walk through the crowd, and people would, you know, I'd always have them upside down, but people would mess with me, whatever. But that one was always easy. And just if you needed to, sometimes radios go down. Sometimes the engineer might have his radio off or not on, you know, because he's working on the show and you need to talk to him about something. It's just such a convenient way to get back and forth. And as Rob said, to bring beers out to the crowd.
Yeah, because I'm that guy. So hey, let's transition a little bit to the Grateful Dead here. Me and Maddie, I think you and I have seen at least probably 30 Grateful Dead shows together. It's something that a lot of people don't know about you, that you're actually a much bigger fan of the band after Garcia passed, and you know, you really just wanted to see further shows and, you know, the rest of that. And you didn't really earn your wings in the lot until way later. And I think that it was probably really tough for you, having seen as many Garcia shows as you did before, like finally kind of, you know, getting the accolades you want as a Grateful Dead fan, like with like the next generation kids that never saw Jerry. So, you know, just to tell Larry and Jim, we were standing in front of the Fox Theater one night. This kid came up to bum a cigarette off of me and Maddie, and neither one of us had one. And instead of saying, you know, thanks and moving on, he looks at both of us totally seriously. He's like, you guys aren't family. and just, we start cracking up. And we're like, all right, who's this like new school Grateful Dead kid that's like shaking down our bona fides? And we're like, okay, I guess we're not family. You know, that's too bad. And just, it's been an ongoing joke ever since of like, Matt, do you have your wings yet? No, man, I ain't get them yet. No one's giving my Grateful Dead wings.
But we're not family. We are not family.
So Maddie, how many shows with Garcia did you see? You had to be, you know, 150 or so in the
time. Yeah, I tried to count. I want to say I'm in like the 140s with Garcia Band and the Grateful Dead together. I started in 87, only saw one show with Dylan and the Dead, and then after that, 89 is really when I started cooking, and then obviously Brent died in that summer, 90, and then 91 I saw almost, shit, I want to say I almost saw every show besides like Canada and maybe a few others, but then started, you know, seeing less and less by 95, but as the scene got pretty out of hand. But
well, you were a dirty dreddy back then.
Yeah, it was part of my life, and I'll definitely never forget it. It was an amazing experience. I think it's just so different.
A big part of this show, that especially last week with Sandy Troy, you know, the four of us sitting here talking, we're a link between Garcia, Sandy Troy, his generation, the people who are at Woodstock. We're a link to the young people who have never seen the Grateful Dead, never saw Garcia. So we can really, you know, pull this whole scene together. We're a very strong link between the generations.
Well, that's awesome, because I think, you know, when Rob and I were young, you know, 17-year-old kids, I felt that, you know, there was lots of older people that kind of guided us, helped us what to do, what not to do.
And we were shitheads. we were total knuckleheads, right? We were out there like causing more trouble than anyone, and we thought it was hilarious. We knew it was kind of fleeting. We were being raised right by our elders, but at the same time, we were the next generation of just wise-ass kids from New York that thought we were hilarious, which we were. But just, you know, causing massive amounts of trouble out in the lot and every sort of, you know, scam we could pull off, whether it was, you know, making our own tickets or whether it was, you know, figuring out how to take a Pepsi machine dry of every soda in the thing by using a fake dollar bill. You know, we had every scam out there that allowed us to get on tour, you know, relatively easily. We could go on for hours on all the ways we did it, which is fun when you read Steve Silverman's book, because he like basically talks about our whole crew in that, in the Skeleton Key. And when it came out, we're like, yeah, we finally got the recognition. But we were a bunch of punk kids that were having a really good time.
Well, I think an awesome story is, I want to say, Oakland Coliseum, Grateful Dead Ticketing had a desk or booth set up outside the show, and one of our friends went up and they had put on the mail orders QT. We were making so many fake tickets at the time, and my friend asked them, "What's that mean?" And he looked up and said, "Quit trying," which is hilarious.
Yeah, I think it was Dennis McNally that used to run that table, and Dennis totally knew what we were up to because we were, you know, it gotten back to him.
Yep. I mean, how many? Well, they would go and collect all the tickets, you know, after the show, obviously, and find out the fakes. Rob knows this story. A Fish show in New Haven, Connecticut, I want to say maybe 1990 or so, in that vicinity. And so we had made not mail orders, but just regular Ticketmaster tickets and used a copier. But stupidly used one that was bought by a credit card of one of our friend's mother, who showed up at the house the next day where Ticketmaster higher-ups asking why they found 100-plus fake tickets in the drop after the show. You know, nothing happened from it, but it was a pretty funny story.
So what we did, Larry and Jim, just kind of, you know, sell ourselves out now that the statute of limitations has long since run, is we got cockier and cockier. We started counterfeiting initially floor tickets, and then we'd say, okay, you know, let's counterfeit like a better section. So we changed the seat number and we changed the row until eventually we started going, well, let's just counterfeit front row. We're not going to go up there, but at least we can get anywhere in the venue, and anyone that shines the light down to check where we are, we can walk anywhere. But once in a while, we'd give tickets to people that didn't really know how to play the rules that we created, and six or seven of them would end up going into the front row, and all of a sudden, the ticket checker would come over and shine the light, and he's like, all seven of you guys have the same ticket number, and just bounce all of them out. Yeah. So, like, the rule was, like, use it for access, but don't use it for anything else. Usually just use it to get in the show, and just don't be a knucklehead once you've done it, and just accept the fact you're getting a free show. But you know, that was, we had it down to a science. We had it down where there's, you know, 15 of us that were working basically like an assembly line, and putting tickets together the night before shows. We'd make 40 or 50 of them to make sure that 15 of us got in, knowing a bunch of us would get stopped at the turnstiles, but everyone else would get in. So, you know, at some point we'll give a dissertation on how to basically why Ticketmaster had to change their policy and start using tickets that had the burn marks on it. I mean, all of that was driven by, you know, creative guys like us.
Yeah, I mean, everything is scannable, whether it is a paper ticket. You know, you can print one out from your printer, and it'll still scan at the gate. So, you know, now that's the new trick, is that people take already scanned tickets, and I think that's why they've moved to the phone, is, you know, I'll get a call from someone outside, man, I bought a ticket in the lot, and it doesn't work at the gate. And I was like, I don't know what you want me to do about it, but go buy another ticket, really, because, you know, that people are assholes, and they'll take those tickets and hand a bunch of their stubs out because they don't get ripped. I mean, when we were going to Grateful Dead and Fish back in the 80s and 90s, they would rip your ticket. And I always used to get mad. I'd say, rip it, you know, cleanly so I could have this for later. But some of them would just rip it right, you know, diagonally or whatever.
Right in the middle of the logo.
Yeah, exactly. But now, you know, every ticket, you know, you see these people with their plastic around their necks, and they have the ticket perfectly embedded in the plastic. And, you know, it's pretty cool as a souvenir, I guess.
Absolutely. Hey, Maddie, in your work, did you ever have an opportunity to get to work with or know any of the guys from the Dead's crew?
Yeah, funny thing. I worked directly for Phil and Friends a few times further. And then the last Mexico gig we did in 2017 with String Cheese it was called Muerte de Queso or something, Queso de Muerte, Dead End Cheese. But it wasn't Dead End Company. It was when it was Bob Weir. It was Bob Weir on front vocals and guitar. It was guy from Joe Russo on guitar, Dave Schools from Panic on bass, Kreutzmann on drums, Jeff Cementi on keys, and I think was that the whole band? No Mickey, no John Mayer. Well, Schools was on bass, so it was a little different. It was really cool. It was a great time. Unfortunately, one of the nights, this is a kind of a crazy story where it was the night Butch Trux passed away. Obviously, Bob Weir was really close to him and took the news pretty badly. We were flip-flopping, opening and closing for each other. I think it was four nights. We were opening that night. So we got done. We got cleared off the stage. Their old stage manager, Chris Cherukee, who's just the biggest clown, really awesome. He since passed away. Would always give me shit for everything. He would just give me shit for working for String Cheese because he would just rag on us all the time. But anyway, he was like, get your shit off the stage. We got to get on there. Anyway, we'd have these joking fights. We'd get off the stage. They get ready and the time starts ticking by and everyone's kind of looking around like, what the hell? No Bob Weir to be found. Time keeps going by. Now I'm thinking this is like an hour. I wouldn't even go out in because I was like, oh, I can go watch the show and have fun as a fan. I went out there and everyone's just jumping me, asking me what's going on, what's going on. I have no idea. So I'm like, man, this is crazy. I go back there and unfortunately, Bob does show up and he had a couple too many. And he was not ready to play. So luckily, Jackie Green at the time was playing the festival that was, one of these all-inclusive things that they do. And it was at the place where...
Playing in the Sand is.
Yeah, exactly. Same spot. And so luckily, Jackie Green was there.
It's Cloud Nine's venue.
Yeah, it wasn't Cloud Nine. It was Chewy and...
consider it CID Entertainment.
CID, that's who Berkowitz. Did it. Yeah, Berkowitz. So anyway... Jackie Green was playing like the pool earlier in the day. He happened to be there. They threw him up on stage for what they thought was going to be the first set, maybe a few songs. He ended up playing the whole show because Weir did show up to the venue, but just was incapacitated. But as a true rock star, I don't know if that show really made it in any of the archives or anything because there was probably maybe 1,500, 2,000 people there at the most. This was before... I think Dead & Co. was a band, but Mayer couldn't do it or something. Anyway, the next night as True Rockstar, Weir came back and just was awesome. I think it was the second song they played Terrapin. And he just, pretended like nothing even ever happened and, just kicked ass. It was really cool to see.
And also, as far as like Dead crew members, like, Steve Parrish.
I've met the real one too, but there's the two that I was the closest to were Cherukee and AJ. I forget his last name. He's got an Italian last name. He's Weir's guitar tech. He's still there, and I know Cherukee worked for the Grateful Dead from like the 90s on, and I think he became a sound engineer, kind of part of the audio crew towards the end of the Grateful Dead's career. And then
you've worked with Tobin, haven't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, Tobin was BGP and Grateful Dead, I think, for a long time as well.
Yeah, one.
Yeah, man, I'm just as a as a guy who's now worked backstage and seen talk about the load in and the load out. Does it give you a new appreciation for the Dead crew in '74 when they were trucking around the country with the Wall of Sound?
Absolutely. When I see pictures of that, it makes me cringe because I can't believe they did that every night. Man, that's just intense, especially for places like Red Rocks where your semi-trucks come into the bottom lot. Then they have to be cross-loaded into a stake bed truck, driven up the hill, unloaded there, then pushed up that massive incline to the stage, then loaded in. So, there's a lot of work, before the gear even makes it to stage. And 1 year, one of the stake bed trucks lost its transmission on the way up. So then they had to run down there, take all the gear out of the back of that truck, put it in another truck to get it up to the stage. And then, you know, after the show, same thing. You're dependent on, it's two trucks going back and forth. Stagehands are loading, unloading or loading the truck which way you're going. And it just takes extra time. I mean, you know, after working 25 string cheese shows with string cheese or so, you know, it's tiring, man. You know, you're there till, say the show ends at 11 o'clock. You're there till 2-3 in the morning by the time you actually like take a breather and you're like, oh, okay, we're almost there. Let's get the hell out of here.
Who, by the way, have one of the kindest, nicest, easiest going group of people that work on that tour. I mean, like, if you want to talk about some of the nicest guys in rock and roll, the String Cheese crew, you know, it takes a lot to get those guys riled up about anything. I've seen a lot of sort of angry crews. String Cheese crew just works really cohesively together. And if they're exhausted and beat, it's because like the work has been exceptionally difficult, especially because those guys do the Cheese as a band do so many creative things, and they bring in so many other, like, you know, acrobats and dancers for big events. They spare no expense to make sure they're putting on a really cool show for, you know, for their major events. But you know, hats off to the entire String Cheese crew.
Yeah, they're awesome, and all, you know, all my brothers, they will be forever, and all the bands, you know, people get bad names for themselves because, oh, they might be dicks or salty, but it's like the longer you work for these bands, and you know, I can vouch, man, it gets annoying, and then they become a dick, not on purpose, because they have to be, because if they show any niceness, people just take advantage. So they're just like, well, I'm better serviced if I just be a dick, so then no one will talk to me. They'll be like, oh, there's that guy, I'm not going near him.
Well, very good. Yeah, we have a little bit of Grateful Dead news here in Colorado. We're getting 3 Phil and Friend shows in September.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's going to play Vail again, where Bob just played, and then Dylan, Ski Town, and then basically in my backyard, maybe 5 miles from my house at Planet Bluegrass.
Well, we'll be checking out Dead & Co. at Wrigley Field right around that time, so there's always a little competition. A
lot of shows coming, a lot of shows.
So, Larry, I know you want to talk about, just real quick today, July 7th, 1969, from Piedmont Park in Georgia, which is a pretty damn fun show. So you want to jump us into that one real fast and just talk about kind of what's happening today in Grateful Dead history?
Yeah, absolutely. I happened to focus back in on the show. We were talking about Big Steve. I was listening to the Big Steve Hour not too long ago, and he was talking about somebody called and asked about Colonel Bruce Hampton. And he started talking about the Colonel and what a great performer he was and how the Colonel and Pigpen became such good friends. And that took him to the show at Piedmont Park, which I guess the Colonel had some role in promoting or participating in one way or another. And the Dead were there, and Pigpen obviously was there performing. And Pigpen and apparently the Colonel became good buddies that night. And Big Steve was just as effusive as always about what a great connection it was and how wonderful it was. But he stopped to say that it's a really good show and you should listen to it. It's not a particularly long show by Dead standards, although I guess for 69 it's not too bad. But it's just basically one set, and it's great. You know, with anytime you see a set that opens with a morning dew, we caught one at 85 Greek Theater the first night to open the second set, but that's great. But you know, Mama Tried, then High Time, Casey Jones, Dark Star, Saint Stephen, The 11, and Turn on Your Love Light. Personally, I'd be fine with that and just go home. But it's a great, great show. And Dan, I believe we have a little bit of music for that show that we can listen to. I have sent Dan a clip from the Love Light towards the closing Love Light. And the Love Light is great for a couple of reasons. One, because it's just a great Love Light, and Pigpen is really on his game, and Bobby really joins in. And the clip we're going to hear is towards the end when Pigpen's kind of in his Turn on Your Love Light chant over and over, and Bobby's filling in, and you can hear the early forms of when Bobby would take over the song later on and really belt it out at that point. But it's interesting, on all of the websites and articles that I read about the show, one of the things that they talked about was that the Allman Brothers were there, and that supposedly Dwayne and Greg Allman sat in with the band on this performance of Love Light. Can't find a straight answer one way or the other. The same websites will say, have guys who wrote in and say they absolutely were not there, and then notes up above that say Allman Brothers sat in with the band on Love Light. So, you know, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. But go ahead and play that for a minute, Dan, because this is really, really good version of Love Light. It goes on like that for 5 minutes, and it just builds and builds and builds. It's great. I just love it.
That Love Light's a monster. It's one of the great ones, and it's such a great lineup. I think Tom Constanton was in the band at the time also. So yep. It's, you know, having Dwayne in there and TC in there is that it's, if you haven't listened to that entire show, it's a rocker.
It really is a rocker, and the whole idea of the festival was great. They had Delaney and Bonnie there. They had Chicago Spirit, some other bands, and but you know, the Dead went down there. They were in the middle of their tour of 69. They had an off night, two off nights between Chicago and Toronto. So Maddie, think about that, an unplanned stop. You're in Chicago, you're supposed to go to Toronto, and you say, what the hell, let's pop down to Georgia for one night and do a quick show like that. You guys ever get put in that type of situation?
We actually did. We were in town. It was in Telluride. But you still have to move the monstrosity of the stage. Monsters of Men, I think, one of their guys got sick. So they just out of the blue said, oh, you guys got to play the Opera House tonight. So we had to move everything from the main stage over there. And, you know, it's just a major pain, especially when you can't get a semi down Main Street off a side street and Main Street Telluride. You got to take a little box truck, move everything one by one kind of thing. And the same thing where we've done the Wakarusa Festival, which is now changed, where we would do the late night tent, say Saturday night, and then we would play Sunday on the main stage. So we basically no sleep, play that show Saturday night, load it all out, load it back in at 6 o'clock in the morning to be ready for like a 4 or 5 o'clock show. I mean, it's just exhausting.
Yeah, so an extra 600 miles one way or the other, no big deal, huh?
That one, I don't know, man. That's a rough one. I don't know how they pulled that one off.
Yep, they did, but it got great reviews, and apparently the Hampton Grease Band played, and they all had a great time, and I never got to see Colonel Bruce Hampton. I never caught one of his shows, to my great regret, but I can only imagine.
We should do a whole show about him, Larry, because, like, you know, for those people out there that don't know enough about Colonel Bruce, he's truly one of the magical people in the jam band community. There isn't a band that I know that I've worked with that, you know, doesn't hold him in just the highest regard for just, you know, kind of what a crazy, nutty guy he was, and just how much influence he had, not just musically, but just as a person on almost everyone, especially when they did Horde Tour back in the day. Anyone that was kind of on those original Horde Tours, being, you know, Fish and Widespread and Dave Matthews Band, you know, all those guys will tell you that, like, their experience of getting to know Colonel Bruce was just unbelievably unique. Traveler, all those guys.
That's how I got turned on to Colonel Bruce and Jimmy Herring, was through Aquarium Rescue Unit, coming around the Fox, Horde Tour, all that stuff. I mean, they were, you know, not no names, but their names weren't as widespread as they are now. And I mean, the coolest thing about Colonel Bruce, rest in peace, but the guy died on stage doing what he loved.
With everyone thinking it was a farce, with everyone thinking this was part of the gig, you know, it's the greatest rock and roll ending of all time. And it's so appropriate for who it was. Like, it could have been anyone else, and the story wouldn't be nearly as poetically, like, you know, perfect. But because it was Bruce doing that, and that's who he is, like, I can't think of another person that could have pulled off that shit as, like, where, like, it's legendary, absolutely legendary, being surrounded by everyone you love at the venue you love, at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, around, like, you know, your biggest fans, your biggest friends, and like, dying on stage where no one believes it's actually happening. It's insane.
They were playing Love Light, weren't they?
They were. Yeah.
There you go.
And it was okay. Minutes before people, you know, even realized, and they said, wait, he isn't joking here. This is real. So it's a absurd story, but that just goes to the territory with, you know, like there's so many Colonel Bruce stories like that, that that this is just the natural conclusion to them.
Yeah, and they had a great interview with O'Teal on this show, and he talked about his experience with Colonel Bruce. And what was funny was, I like the fact that O'Teal said, you know, so here's Colonel Bruce. He's a few years older than me, and people talk about Colonel Bruce being a good athlete. We can save this all for the Colonel Bruce show. But supposedly O'Teal tells us how Colonel Bruce played a mean tennis game and a mean golf game and regularly took people to the cleaners because they misjudged him based on looking at him instead of, you know, knowing what he could do.
Another game for Milos.
So that'll be a good topic for us. I like that idea, Rob. Let's find a good show, a good date, and we'll do a Colonel Bruce show and talk about his influence on the jam band scene. That would be wonderful. Very good. Jim, what else you got for us? Any more shows coming up?
Well, like I said, I got my Phil and Friends tickets. Kind of happy about that. Thinking about going to New Orleans Jazz Fest. Got Mexico in January. So, yeah, lots of good shows coming up. And, God, it's still June, technically, and next week will be July, and I've already been to Red Rocks four times.
You can break your own personal record. And, Maddie, I look forward to seeing you. I've already got my Anders tickets for Chicago in October and Evanston at Space, which is
cool.
One of my favorite.
I was just talking about that. I've never been to that venue.
Oh, it's an amazing little venue. It's 5 minutes from my house. And quite frankly, I've seen Anders in a bunch of places. But Space is so small. I know this is an acoustic tour, but we saw him in there one night with his power trio. And, you know, he just blew the doors down. It was unbelievable. He's become one of my favorites over the last few years.
I was reading that's only a 250 people venue.
Yep. Behind a pizza parlor.
Really intimate show.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But I will be there, so I will look for you to give you a big hello. But I will not be asking you for tickets.
That's your chance. Show up at Larry's law firm and just start, like, making a ruckus on that day. And just be like, yeah, I'm here, man.
You act like that would be a problem for me. I'd invite you right in. We'd have a great time. You know, I know you're sober now, but you always have to be ready. You never know who's going to swing by, so.
Never trust a prankster.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me.
No, this has been great, Maddie. The stories are wonderful, and, you know, all the information you can share with our listeners is great. And, you know, it's always good to have somebody who's been right there and seen it all and, you know, can kind of explain some of the mysteries that, you know, the rest of us always just kind of wonder about. So thank you so much for being on our show. Jim, any parting words?
No, over and out here from Longmont, Colorado. And it's going to be a great summer with lots of shows. And yeah, I'm going to fill in too. I forgot to mention Eileen Jewell is coming, one of a real bluesy gal singer, has a lot of songs on the radio. And of course, we've got three shows for Fish on Labor Day weekend. So won't be any cobweb on my shoe.
Very good. Rob?
Yeah, I mean, as you guys know, I normally end these things with some sort of wise-ass comment of, like, what substances to take and what not to take. But in this case, I want to put it out there for all your friends out there that, you know, sobriety is a choice. Support those friends, you know, and give them the love they need as they make that decision in their life, because it's really important for a lot of people to make that decision. So I've known Maddie for a long, long time, and I can tell you that I'm more proud of him as a friend right now than I've ever been, watching him go through a transition that, you know, has led to a lifestyle change that I think is, you know, a great one for him. So if you guys have friends out there, certainly give those guys, you know, as much as you can to continue forward on the path that's right for them.
I think that's a great message, Rob. Thank you for sharing. I do have a couple of friends who have gone down that path themselves. And what we find is that they're still the most fun guys to hang out with during the show. So, you know, it works out well for everyone. But thanks again to Maddie Veach for taking time to talk with us. Thank you, as always, to our producer, Dan Humiston. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great week. And please enjoy your cannabis responsibly. ¶¶